Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome from Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today I'm proud to bring you another episode of our Sword and Sandal Cinema Special. Today our hosts are Nick Curto and Diana Monfort. I will be starting out with one of my Legends of Hercules reviews. Today of Hercules Conquers Atlantis, also known as Hercules and the Captive Women. After some good-natured brawling in a local tavern, King Androcles of Thebes, the mighty Hercules, and his son Hylas, plus their diminutive companion Timoteo, share an ominous experience. Tiresias, the seer of Thebes, informs them that the gods have spoken and that a peril from the far west, beyond the straits, threatens all of Greece. Unable to rally his fellow kings or their collective citizenry, Androcles gathers an unwilling crew and, with the help of Hylas and Timoteo, drugs and kidnaps Hercules, who had decided to sit this one out. The sea voyage is doomed. Mutiny is followed by storm, then shipwreck. Hercules finds himself alone and afloat in misty waters. After praying to Zeus, he locates an island, defeats the shapeshifter Proteus, and rescues Ismene, princess of Atlantis. The protective mist that long hid Atlantis from the eyes of intruders is also lifted. Making their way to Atlantis, they encounter many mysteries. Just who exactly is the instrument of true deific will in these particular circumstances? Why would Queen Antinea gleefully sacrifice her own daughter? What is King Androcles doing here? Why does he now have amnesia and firmly support acts of Atlantean imperialism? Why do evil queens always fall for Hercules, and why are they outraged when he predictably spurns them? With the guidance of Zenith, Prince of Uranus, the blessings of Zeus, and some help from his companions, including Ismene, Hercules rescues Androcles, rekindles hope in the hearts of doomed mind slaves, leads an uprising, and thwarts the schemes of Queen Antinea, which include gaining personal immortality, plotting world domination, and misusing the blood of her god to create mutants and amass the race of manly blonde clones. He also rights many wrongs, restores balance to the heavens, and almost single-handedly destroys the island kingdom. Greece is saved. Androcles is restored. Hylas and Ismene are going steady. Timoteo is unharmed, and Hercules is in good spirits. Together, they sail towards the rising sun and home. I enjoyed this movie a great deal. Reg Park delivers one of my favorite portrayals of the Theban Hercules, and the many unfortunate appeals to and affirmations of the power of Uranus lend much unintended humor to this fun mythic adventure. And now, the Legend of Hercules having been completed, we welcome Nick Curto. Greetings and welcome, Nick. How are you, sir?
Oh, very well, Hercules. You know, the sword and sandal genre films are so much fun. I love them so much. They were one of my early favorite of films. Also, I liked cowboy films too when I was a young man, a young boy. But sword and sandal were very, very special and opened up so much new ground for me. I was brought up in Springfield, Massachusetts, and a typical little boy. Loved to have adventures with friends, and we would play games. And some of those games absolutely were derived from the films we saw for the Sword and Sandal films.
Mm-hmm.
And they were great, great fun. Such adventurous storylines that the films had. And, you know, the heroes conquering the evil barbarians and saving the damsels in distress, so to speak, fighting for what's right and good. And so this was easy then to make up little scenarios with my friends. Again, we were probably like 8, 7, 8, 9, something like that. I grew up in the 50s, pretty much when this was going on, 50s and 60s. And so these stories were so wonderful and opened up so many different avenues of thinking also. And they're responsible those wonderful films were responsible for some great, great adventures that I had.
Can you remember any
related to those? Yeah, some of the simple stories that they had, kids can relate to them very, very well. And also the whole idea about there was gods that were manipulating in some cases what the humans on our planet were thinking and doing. This was very, very interesting material for a young boy to assimilate. And we would make costumes. We would find wood, probably from discarded boxes from the store, and we would make shields, and we would make wooden swords. And
wow.
I remember that we also would fashion capes. Capes somehow were very important. We would put capes on, and we would simulate these fight scenes, as well as the other negotiating scenes and finding treasures. All of that was part of our play.
Yeah, that's amazing. That sounds like a lot of fun. I used to do similar things when I was growing up. I grew up in the 60s and 70s played very much the same games. We put together costumes. I was fortunate enough to go to a Greek school. So we had all these plays that we used to put on as well as what we did in our play. So it was a lot of fun.
Great fun. And this was really a part of growing up. And we would play act this. And a couple of very surprising things would also happen during this time. And I wanted to go into that a little bit because this is, to me and some other, I'm sure thousands of other little boys out there, a couple of things happened because of these films that is never, ever discussed. And I think it's also very important that it's brought out. So if I may, I want to go
sure.
into these very surprising occurrences that happened because of the sword and sandal films. Happened to boys, especially little boys in the 50s and 60s. Those were very hard times for people like me, little boys growing up, because those films awoken some feelings that were very deeply buried or just beginning to be realized about the fact that we were feeling a little differently in the sense of our sexuality. And
mm-hmm.
although we didn't, in some cases, even know what the word gay meant, we were feeling things when we were seeing these images of these heroes, these super hunk, muscled heroes in these films. And they look so great and magnificent. And it also awoken feelings of what's going on here. I'm attracted to that sort of imagery. And there was absolutely, as you know, no helpful books, no movies of that time really depicting positive characters that were gay or lesbian anywhere. It was a very repressed atmosphere. Very, very harsh times there. People would be arrested, I found out later, if they were even suspected of being gay and arrested or thrown out of the pubs that they were in, and in some cases were beat up if anyone suspected that they were gay. And so as a little boy, seeing these characters on screen awoke in certain feelings that some of us face that, others kind of repress that, but it was a very interesting time. Later on, young men would lose their jobs. They would be disowned from their families. They would lose their friends. They would be beat up if they were found out to be gay. So it was a very, very harsh reality that was going on at that time. And nobody was coming at time at all. This was highly repressed. And you didn't even want to think about it or talk about it. So for gay little boys like me, it was a very difficult time. Again, no books, movies depicting gay characters, so forth. And looking at these films, I have to tell you that there were aha moments. aha moments when you thought, you know, I'm very attracted to these superheroes, and for good reason. They were heroes. Everybody loved them. They were fighting for right. They were fighting for what was good. And it was a very attractive imagery that we were trying to emulate when we were doing looking at these films. Men were dressed in loincloths and sandals.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it awoke in some very subtle feelings. And I'm not the only one here at all. There were, I'm sure, thousands of young men that were feeling something like that. And at the time, with absolutely no support of any kind, we're trying to deal with these images and trying to understand what was going on, how our feelings were there, obviously there, and how to try to deal with that. So that was one of the surprising things that was going on that very few people ever bring up or talk about, but I think it was an important subject to bring to light here.
Well, it's good that the films were able to accomplish that much-needed social function. With me, it was the fact that I was Greek and that these heroes, even though the actors were in Greek, were portraying mostly Greek heroes, and that their physiques looked like the statues of old. So what it did for me on a spiritual level, that's where I responded, was that if these people could portray it this in our day and age and be very recognizably the heroes of old, then, you know, it's possible to recapture that spirit from antiquity and to do good with it in the here and now and have adventures in the here and now. So for me, it served a spiritual purpose. And many of the guests we've had on the Sword and Sandal Cinema Special have expressed the same thing that you've expressed. So I'm sure it was very universal. You know, the fact that the Sword and Sandal Cinema helped to identify and define their sexuality. So thank you for sharing that, because it's very important that these films are more than what people just think, which is popcorn entertainment. They served very many people in very many ways, and all of these ways were important.
These were and are incredible films. And also another very, very surprising thing was also occurring, which is very subtle, but was certainly there. And as I was thinking about growing up, and the relation to these amazing films, something else that I want to discuss with you briefly, which was these movies had scores, musical scores in the background that sounded very symphonic. When the triumph that was being portrayed in music, not only a triumph, but music dealing with love, symphonic music dealing with suspicion, victory, sweeping music as our heroes were going to various different places of the planet. And that kind of classic music that we were hearing, and this, by the way, was not only in Sword and Sandal films, but also the cowboy films we were seeing. That's mm-hmm. the kind of music that they were playing in the background. And nobody ever discusses this, but what it did was, in my case, and many other cases, I'm sure, made us very fans of this wonderful symphonic music. We didn't hear it any other places on television, usually, or in our worlds. Symphonic music wasn't there. Popular music was, but not symphonic. So, and I remember, and I wanted to ask you if you were doing this too, we would be, when we were in the process of like taking swords and fighting, making believe fighting with our friends, and we would be humming or singing this symphonic music. Dum da da da, dum da 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 da, ba 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 ba. And we were actually doing that. Do you remember this?
Yes, I used to do the same thing. Dun, da, da, dun, da, 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 da.
Right. We were making up these
the adventure.
We were making up these wonderful musical scores as we were portraying our heroes. And that it's so interesting that we were doing that. I forgot all about this until I was thinking back. And the other part of that is that later on, when we were going to school, at least when I was going to New England, Springfield, Mass., they had a symphonic orchestra, and part of the school education program was to bring us to symphonies. Actually, the Springfield symphonies, which were incredibly wonderful, and they would bring us to some of the concerts so that we would hear symphonic music. But if we were looking at these films on our own, that wasn't brand new to us. We kind of appreciated, right, the symphonic music. So when we got to these concerts, we kind of had one step ahead of everybody else. We enjoyed, in some cases, that music brought up the images of the Sword and Sandal films. And so we were kind of on board with that well before our classmates.
Yeah, that added quite a dimension, and it was there also in some of the science fiction and superhero type of films and entertainment as well, like on Superman on TV, and so that became part of the adventure. You know, you had this symphonic operatic music accompanying your heroic deeds.
Right, and that was all happening when we were looking at those kind of films. So it really is quite wonderful when you think back, and that we were actually humming. We weren't humming what we were hearing. We were kind of making it up. We were making up symphonic symphonies in our mind and humming and singing them as we were portraying our heroes that we saw on screen. So I thought that was really interesting. I wanted to also mention, if we have a little more time, some of the more wonderful films of that genre. For instance,
sure,
the Hercules movie of 1958. What an incredible, incredible movie that was. And again, it was one of those movies that you saw and you wanted to emulate. And it was one of those films. Also, A Son of Samson, 1960. Now that was an interesting on a lot of levels, and the fact that there was a depiction there of some of the characters in there that had very attractive feelings for one another, including two males in that movie, and that also it was very subtle, very very subtle love story going on between two hunks, but it was there. And again, in those days, there wasn't anything else around that was portraying feelings of mutual attraction. Of course, the big one, Spartacus of 1960, I'm sure that you've seen that more than once.
Yes.
Incredible film it was. Also, Kurt Douglas, Peter Ustinov, Gene Simmons, Lawrence Oliver, all these amazing actors in that film when the Hollywood got going with this genre, and those are memorable films. Also, Valley of the Lions, 1961. Did you see that?
That I've seen, but I don't really remember. I've watched so many of these movies so many times that after a while they just blend into one big story. But that rings a bell. Yes, I've probably seen it.
Right. It was another one of those movies. And, of course, they had, as actors, basically people who were bodybuilders and athletes that had physiques that were amazing. So, again, these men who took these roles weren't really actors at the beginning. They were people, athletic people, bodybuilders, winning bodybuilder contests, and that's how they were discovered. So acting was not their first talent. So a lot of these emerging stars, had to learn acting. And you can kind of see that in some of the depictions, because they weren't as strong actors as they were physical bodybuilders. So it was a combination of that was kind of interesting, the way they were depicted on screen. Another one of my favorites, I've seen this recently too, was Jason and the Argonauts from 1963,
yes,
with the fighting skeletons. Do you remember that?
Yes, I've seen that. That ties into my personal history. I'm a Lemnian Greek, and Lemnos is the island of the women, the Amazons,
yep,
that the Argonauts stopped at. So we have all sorts of stories that aren't even in the myths about what the Argonauts did. They stayed for around 2.5 years, and their children ruled the island until they were deposed by barbarians and sailed to Africa. There's tons and tons and tons of mythology I grew up with on that particular myth. So that one's near and dear to my heart.
Me too. And when I still can remember all the skeletons with swords and shields that were fighting. And this was all stop animation. Of course, stop animation means you have to move like puppets, so to speak, a tiny fraction of an inch, take a picture, move it another tiny fraction of an inch, take another picture. And after months of stop animation photography, you would have the scene. And some of these scenes had many skeletons fighting.
Yeah.
And it was an amazing thing to see. And the stop animation was able to capture monsters and dragons and all kinds of evil creatures by way of stop animation. And it was very unique and quite attractive. Another one I'd like to mention was a Clash of the Titans from 1981. I'm sure a lot of people saw that.
Yes.
And Harry Hamlin was the featured actor in that film. Now, another one that comes to mind, although I don't remember it very well, was Red Soja from 1985, and that was featured a female hero.
Yes.
Kind of a Conan the Barbarian.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that at all?
Oh, yeah, I'm a big Conan fan, and I remember when Red Sonja first came out in comic books, she was based on another character called Red Sonja that was created by the same author that created Conan, Robert E. Howard. So, yeah, I'm a big Red Sonja fan as well.
And that was very unique to have a female being the hero of the film. Bridget Nielsen was the star of that, and very unforgettable. And of course, one of the big ones we can all relate to is Gladiator of the year 2000. What a tremendous work that was, visually, acting wise, the score, everything.
One of our hosts, the other Nicholas, Nicholas Dyack, he wrote the book on the new peplums that started with Gladiator. And the book's called The New Peplum, too. So he's chronicled the entire rise of these movies out of obscurity, and he continues to do so on his website and on his shows.
Interesting. Russell Crowe, of course, was the lead in that. And Russell Crowe, of course, is an actor, not as much of a bodybuilder as an actor. And, of course, that's shown through with very, very good acting abilities that is in that film. And, of course, the other film that I think is extraordinary and highly memorable is 300 from 2006.
Mm-hmm.
What a film that was.
That was based on a comic book series and later a graphic novel by Frank Miller, the comic book legend.
Yes, absolutely. I have to say, now I took up, I went to art school and I majored in graphic advertising design. So my outlook is always on design and form. And this was art direction times a million. The art direction in this film was spectacular. It looked different than any other film I've ever seen in that genre. The people that were the soldiers and the key figures had incredible bodies, and we learn after we were reading about it that a lot of airbrushing took place on their actual bodies to make their abs look
yes.
Like steel, right? Do you remember this?
Yes, yeah, to match the pictures in the comic book, they spray painted abs on some of the actors.
And it worked. I was thinking when I was looking at this film, how did these people get so built up and amazing muscles? I mean, you could see them from a plane, the abs that they had. And also the coloring of the film was different too. It looked like it was highly retouched and gone over. So the look of the film was dark with a muted color, a lot of browns and blacks and gray tones in the film itself. And it gave it kind of, what shall I say, like you were in a time machine and actually looking at the history. It felt like that.
Yeah, yes, it did. On that note, we have to start wrapping up this segment. Nick, always a pleasure to be speaking with you about any topic. We range from UFOs to ancient civilizations to sword and sandal superheroes. So I always enjoy our conversations. How can people learn more about you, and how can they tap into all the wonderful things that you're doing?
Thank you so much, Hercules, for that question. They could reach me by my email. That would be the very best way to do that. I'll give you my email address, which is NICKNYNY1. And it's the numeral one, not O-N-E, but the numeral one at gmail.com. Again, NICKNYNY1 at gmail.com. And I would love to have any comments or questions that anyone in our audience has. I'd be more than happy to address that. And what a pleasure always to be on a program with you, Hercules. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. And I look until our next conversation. Be well and happy New Year. And now we're going to play a quick song, If You Can Dream, and then we'll return with another of Legend of Hercules, and then onward to Diana Monfort.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till it's real. If you can dream, then you can be bound by love and yet be free, but only if you can dream. When love and trust are deep and fair, there is nothing your heart won't dare, but only if you can dream. Dream till you wake. Dream till you feel. Dream till you know it. Dream till you feel. till it's real. Dream till it's real. Dream till it's real.
Greetings and welcome back to Sword and Sandals Cinema Special. I am Hercules Invictus, and next is Diana Monfort, but first, another Legend of Hercules. Since Plato first penned his foundational works, many a tale teller has spun a fantastic yarn of long ago times and set it in ancient Atlantis. One of the most recent was a television series that explored the lost continent through the lens of Greek mythology. Epic heroes like Jason and Hercules, along with historical figures like Pythagoras, adventured in a land not unlike Minoan Crete and revisited the classical legends. Though unseen, Poseidon is an all-powerful and forever presence. Alas, the series was not renewed for the third season, which is unfortunate as it was leading to the voyage of the Argo. But the two-season adventure is now immortalized on Blu-ray, DVD, and streaming. And today we're going to look at episode 2, 3, and 4. Episode 2, A Girl by Any Other Name. Jason discovers that he's originally from Atlantis and that he has a destiny. While seeking answers, he rescues Medusa from Maenads and Satyrs. Though freed, she is cursed by a dying Maenad. Episode 3, A Boy of No Consequence. Hercules admits to having feelings for Medusa, and Princess Ariadne discovers that she has feelings for Jason. The three companions are condemned to the bullpit for preventing Hippotrion, Ariadne's intended, from further abusing a peasant. Despite Queen Pasiphae's use of sorcery, the heroes triumph with some help from Medusa. And episode 4, Twist of Fate. Jason, Hercules, and Pythagoras discover an abandoned baby while hunting. With the help of Medusa, they unravel the mystery of the child's parentage. There's lots of intrigue and adventure as the Oedipus cycle takes root and plays out in mythic Atlantis. And now onward to Diana Monfort. Greetings and welcome, Diana. How are you?
Well, how are you? Hi, I'm Diana Monfort, and I am transgendered, which means I was born male, became female. And yes, indeed, those hot sword and sandal movies jump-started my sexuality. I remember the first moment of profound sexual excitement when I was 8 after seeing one of those movies on television. So if I were in one, I'd be the queen of Uranus. But anyway, I want to talk about these two amazing films from the 1950s, both from the mid-1950s, one called Land of the Pharaohs and one called The Prodigal. Land of the Pharaohs stars then absolutely sizzling Joan Collins. She's like 20 years old when she makes this. It is the most amazing film. I mean, in spite of the Hays Code and, you know, all the censorship, I mean, my God, she's almost topless, she's flogged, it's like, what? You know, I mean, what is this? It's amazing. And it also stars, all the great English actors who needed the rent money, you know. So They stepped away from the Shakespearean stage and dipped a toe in peplum waters, and it's very good. I mean, it's camp. It's total camp. It's silly. It's great. Many of these wonderful films have a very strong element of camp. I mean, of they're sending it up. But it's so much fun, you know? And I mean, the gorgeous men in these films. Well, hello. It is fantastic. And the gorgeous women. Joan Collins is absolutely phenomenal in this film. By her own admission, she didn't quite know what she was doing. But it really, I mean, you know, she has the sexuality of a very young woman, and you know how strong the mating instinct is when you're very young, and She's just amazing, an amazing actress in that, and in many other things, of course. But, yeah, it's certainly a film I recommend that people see. Really, it has something for everyone. It's at the end, poor Joan, who plays Nellifer, who manages to become the Queen of Egypt. You know, those queens of Egypt don't end well. I mean, Cleopatra, you know, it's just sad. But anyway, Nellifer runs afoul of the Prime Minister. And when her husband dies, maybe she killed him, they break all these little sort of stone pustules in the pyramid and sand comes rushing in. And Joan is going to get her lip gloss must. She just, it's bad news for Joanie. What can I say? But, and then there's The Prodigal, starring that avatar of great acting, Lana Turner. Yes, I'm being ironic. She didn't want to do it, but she wasn't getting any younger, and she was assigned the film. So she gritted her cap teeth and did it. But it's great. I mean, her daughter wrote that Lana and her co-stars would often burst out laughing in the middle of a take at the dialogue they'd have to say. But she redesigned her costumes so that she's almost naked in some scenes. She plays the world's only blonde-haired, blue-eyed Arab maiden who is, you know, the queen of something or other. And she, you know, she says, well, as soon as my people see me, they will stop this madness. Well, they don't. And she jumps into the pit, oh, God, and just, I guess, sizzles away into platinum smoke. And it's very sad. But anyway, but yeah, that's also a fun film. And it stars Edmund Purdom, who was in The Egyptian.
Mm-hmm.
He built sort of a minor career on loincloths and sandals, and he certainly did a nice job on that one. As an actor, well, but as a hottie, yes. So, you know, he and Lana did not like each other, which made things difficult since they had to do love scenes and, you know, whatever. But both these films are camp extravaganza supreme. They're great. If you watch them in a spirit of, you know, golden age of Hollywood glamour, they're a lot of fun. They have no ties to reality at all, none. But they are great fun. And do you have any questions?
No. I'm delighted at your interpretation of the films. Yeah, they are very campy, unintentionally so, because they had low budgets, many of them. Although some
Well, no, these two are actually quite high budget.
Uh-huh. Yeah, some had very high budget.
I mean, yeah, they're high budget films. And they are made for, you know, every audience. They're made for little boys and grown men who want to see Lana and Joan, you know, semi-undressed, and women who want to check out the interesting hairstyles and makeup. They're made for everyone. Excuse me. Joan was later up for the role of Cleopatra, but didn't get it. We know who did, Liz Taylor. And ultimately, she did play Cleopatra on a 1980s episode of Fantasy Island. But she's had an interesting career, you know.
Uh-huh.
I mean, up, down, up, down, up, down, up, down. In the 70s, she was making horror films at J. Arthur Rank in England. And then, of course, came Dynasty, which propelled her into the absolute stratosphere. So that's interesting. Lana later was on, I think, Knott's Landing or, the Jane Wyman show, whatever that one was. It was about a winery. But she competed with Jane a little too well, and Jane had her character killed. So there you go.
Ooh,
what do you expect from Ronald Reagan's ex-wife, you know?
So you discovered these films very young, and they impacted you in a tremendous way, and they still have relevance in your life. What do you think of these movements to go backwards with people's sexualities? That seems to be a very hot issue these days. I remember locally, even in the school board election, that you know, took up a lot of time, energy, and attention. I think it's horrible to have anybody pretend to be that which they're not or who they're not, and to go back to days when nobody talked about anything.
Well, we can't, because the genie's out of the bottle, and the LGBTQ plus community is a sizable voting bloc, and we have money to spend on products. And one reason for this backlash against the LGBTQ plus folk is that we're visible now. We cannot be cowed the way we were in the 1950s when The Prodigal and Land of the Pharaohs came out. We refuse to go back in the closet. And that, of course, makes so-called conservatives, they're always mocking, you know, the woke cause. And, you know, if you listen to right-wing radio, which I do to hear what the competition is up to, they apparently despise personal freedom, poor people, pretty much everyone, you know. So, really, yes, it's terrible that this is happening, but this time around it will not triumph. It will not be another McCarthy era, because we won't allow it to be. And that's the way it is. And the so-called conservatives had better realize that most of the world is not conservative. People want their freedom. They want to have a good life. They do not want to suffer in poverty and repression, which apparently is what the conservatives want. And we say no, and that's it. You know, I mean, no. And they cannot. I know that, of course, the Supreme Court, the very conservative Supreme Court, would like to turn the clock back. But as they saw when they repealed Roe v. Wade, the so-called Dobbs decision, that didn't play. And we Democrats, cleverly, I think, inserted interracial marriage into the marriage equality bill. We're looking at you, Clarence Thomas. So, you know, I mean, Clarence Thomas apparently didn't realize that in certain sections of the South in the United States, an interracial marriage is infinitely, infinitely more transgressive than a same-sex marriage. And I think that was brought home to him. And they want to do away with birth control and other things. And if they do that, they will create a black market, not unlike prohibition. And that's not a great thing to do, because then you're, you know, encouraging criminality. You are making people criminals simply for wanting to limit their families or for having same-sex sex. And these things have always existed. They always will. They cannot be controlled. This is the nature of human beings. Different strokes for different folks, as they used to say. And no court, no king, no government can regulate what people do when they want to do it. And that's that. What do you think?
There you go. I'd vote for you.
Thank you. Wasn't this supposed to be about sword and sandal movies? But anyway,
well, I'll get back to that. Talking about like sword and sandal type of themes, as I said earlier, with me, it was on a spiritual level that I interacted with the films, and the fact that it reinforced the stories from my heritage. My beliefs are very mythic, and they use the Greek and Roman myths extensively. And now, in addition to people's gender choices and sexuality being under the gun, people's spiritual beliefs are under the gun again, too, again, regressing backwards. And I too watch the videos of people and read the tales and opinions of people who believe very differently than I do. And there, too, my spirituality is being labeled as demonic. And all sorts of
First of all, it's not a choice to be trans. You are. That's just the way it is. Second, they label anything they don't like as demonic to instill fear in the populace. And that's they've been doing that since the dawn of the Judeo-Christian ethic, which to a degree is a good thing because it promoted love and, but only one kind of love. They do not want people to have freedom. They want people to feel guilty. Sin, ooh, and original sin. You're born a sinner. No, you're not. You're born human, and you do whatever you do. And so long as you don't hurt anyone, you're not hurting anyone. But of course, a few people set themselves up as leaders and try to crush everyone else's freedom. Meanwhile, they have private islands with underage girls and other things, So there you go. I mean, really. Roy Cohn was gay. He was McCarthy's right-hand person. And Roy Cohn said, I'm not gay. I just like to fool around with men. Yeah, okay. So, I mean, I don't care, and most people don't care what the conservatives think. We will do what we will do. I'm old enough to remember when being trans was illegal, and I did it anyway. And we had a thriving subculture before all this wonderful trans acceptance. And should we have to go underground again, I suppose we can. But as I've said, we're a sizable voting bloc, and that's what counts to politicians. Even the Republicans voted to keep gay marriage. And we have money to spend, and those two things make us invincible. They cannot get rid of us because we are too important to the economy and to the political system. And if you vote for me,
there you go. And like the sword and sandal cinema movies of old, it seems that there are still injustices to fight in the world and tyrants to confront and topple. Those of you who grew up watching these movies got the inspiration from there as well to fight into the real world.
Exactly. And that is the greatest thing. Oppressed peasants in ancient Greece or Rome or wherever are not unlike workaday people today.
Right.
And the sword and sandal heroes were always on the side of the peasantry and helped them to overcome the tyranny of whatever, the emperor, the king, whatever, So they were a wonderful example of guerrilla fighting, of underground principles for freedom. They were always, on the side of freedom. You never saw a sword and sandal hero who wanted to crush people to make them toe the line. Sword and sandal heroes were always heroes. They helped people. They helped people to be free. They helped people to think for themselves. They instilled those thoughts in people. They told them, you have a right to demand this. You have a right to freedom. Unlike, the Grand Vizier who would have people beheaded for looking at him the wrong way.
Back in the day, I guess the late 90s, early 2000s, I started an Age of Heroes, or I declared an Age of Heroes in New York City, and I had a television show that chronicled this, and I had all sorts of strange adventures, but a lot of it focused on helping people. Or accomplishing things that seemed impossible or really difficult, then pulling them off in a few months or a year. That's what the theme of the show is about. And I found in my talking with people who worked in human service organizations or other type of organizations that they too were inspired by these movies, and they wanted to be the heroes in these movies. So they got involved. Not because of who I was or what I was asking them to do, but because it was an adventure and it was one of these sword and sandal adventures. They wanted to be like Jason and the Argonauts, and here's Hercules. So we're going to go after the Golden Fleece. We're going to share it with humanity. And we fought social monsters. Like one of them was the digital divide, which eventually people decided didn't exist, but back then it was a reality. The computers were rising. They were being used increasingly more, but a lot of people couldn't afford computers, and there were no classes to tell people how to use computers, and there was no access to computers. Eventually, Bill Gates solved that by giving libraries computers, but at the time we did The Age of Heroes, that wasn't the reality that we were living in. So just
well, I own a computer, but I've only used it once.
There you go.
Under my boyfriend did it for me, and I have no clue as to how to use one. I'm not mechanical. I do not own a cell phone. I do not wish to own a cell phone. You know, and going back to the sword and sandal films, it was a very safe way of promoting democratic principles. You said it way in the past, and the powers that be don't realize how relevant those films are to the world of today. Or they do realize it, but there's not much they can do about it.
Very, very true. It's like science fiction. It's set in the far future on other planets, but it's actually a social commentary that has very much to do with what's going on here and now.
Well, the show MASH, the television show, was about Vietnam, even though it was set during the Korean War. Yeah.
Yeah. So these films actually resonated with people on a wide range of levels for a wide range of reasons, and they inspired people to take that heroic spirit that was portrayed in the story, even though the story might have been campy, whether it was low budget or high budget, it was campy, many of them, and bring it, kindle a flame inside themselves and bring it to problems we have in the here and now. And
I
some
agree.
Of them,
yeah.
Some of them were quite conscious of this, and some weren't. But I remember during The Age of Heroes, people were very conscious of it, and they verbalized it over and over and over again. And we went to conferences of professionals and introduced finding the hero within and applying the heroic spirit to your challenges in daily life. So it resonated for quite a while. And September 11th, too, was like that kind of stopped everything dead in its tracks. But people rose up to that occasion, too. And even though our world had changed and I couldn't walk around Manhattan with a sword anymore because there were people in army suits with no
with guns. Yeah. Assault rifles. Yeah. Yeah. It was.
Yeah.
And I suspect that September 11th was really about doing away with people's individual rights. I think, I mean, come on, building number 7, it just falls. I mean, please, come on, you know?
That's a topic for another show.
Yeah, but anyway, but what we need is, you know, some wonderful superheroes to save us. But anyway, but I believe in what?
We have all that inside of us, though. We're the superheroes, and it's up to us.
Exactly,
to save us.
Yeah.
And
well, all we need is a few sword and sandal movies to show the way, and that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And then we find the superhero within.
Like Nick had pointed out, he liked the sword and sandal movies and also the cowboy movies. There's also the kung fu movies, and all of them have the message that the individual or unindividual or a small group of individuals has more power than a nation and a tyrant and oppression, that, you know, that we have it within ourselves to confront this evil and to say no to it and to topple it.
Yes, but I don't think one person can do it. I think we have to coalesce and all the groups have to come together, divide and conquer. Is a principle that the powers that be use to keep, excuse me, to keep us from, you know, coming together and overthrowing them. That was, you know, in places like Russia in 1917, France 1789, people actually said, screw this. And they all got together and overthrew tyranny. And this is why you have racial prejudice in this world and homophobia, transphobia, every kind of phobia, so that we won't coalesce and, you know, tell the powers that be, we, the people, are the powers that be. Remember, there are more of us than there are of anyone else, we the people. And that's something that the powers that be know and scares them to death.
And the, as Nick pointed out, too, and others have pointed out, the Sword and Sandal Cinema movies, they are for, like, democracy, even though they have...
Well, I just said that, yeah.
Now, you'd say that also, that they have, they support democratic principles and principles
and
that are all Western principles.
And people like Hercules come and teach the peasants, the illiterate, deliberately kept illiterate, toil-weary peasants, taught these people not only that they have rights, but how to get those rights and make those rights a reality, you know? And they just said, you do not have to take this. It's like Howard Beale in Network. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what the Sword and Sandal heroes told the so-called peasantry. And look, we're all peasants. I mean, who isn't a peasant, you know?
We all are all things, and we take some of those all things and we manifest them in the here and now and live out stories, some of them good stories, some of them not so good stories, but we have it within our power to change the stories for ourselves and for our various circles of influence. It's more up to us than we believe.
I agree. Not only in the real physical world, but also psychically. You know, we can imagine a reality and make it come to pass.
Well, I restarted the Age of Heroes here in Jersey, and we've touched New York and other places already. So I'm going to invite you on one of our Age of Heroes shows.
I would love it.
We covered the elections for the Board of Education here in Tenafly.
I heard those shows. They were great, yeah.
Thank you. And our mayor has been on, some of our council people, and we have a
when you had the mayor on, I know we have no time, but I never knew what a mayor, I'm in politics here in Manhattan. I never knew what a mayor did. When I heard the mayor of Tenafly talking about what a mayor did, now I know what a mayor does. Okay, good.
That was the intent, to just ask these questions. And,
did you know what a mayor does? I didn't.
No, I wasn't until I asked them. I had no idea. I had a vague idea. They were in charge of whatever area they were mayor of.
Yeah, I was. I didn't know. No.
Now, how can people get in contact with you? Because you're not.
Well, they can contact you, and you'll pass the message on to me.
We will do that most definitely, I promote your shows here on my platform. On,
third Saturday of the month from 9 to 10 at night, the Diana Montfort Show podcast. And we often interview LGBTQ guests. We have a wonderful guest coming up soon, this January 21st, I think. It is Rena Dunsworth. She's a published author. She's trans. She has an amazing story, an amazing story. You really want to hear this, you know.
I offer to all of my hosts and all of my guests that if they're doing anything, I'll promote it on my platform. So if you let me know when and where your shows are airing.
Well, no, it's your podcast that I'm talking about.
Oh, okay, but beyond the podcast, if you're doing anything, I'd be more than happy.
Well, they're building a new studio, MNN. And supposedly we will come back in January.
Okay, awesome.
Until then, we are in reruns.
Welcome to the Age of Heroes. Thank you very much, Diana. Always a pleasure, both on and off the air, to be speaking with you. And I wish
Mine
you a very
too.
Welcome and happy New Year.
Right back at you.
And we'll close with Mighty Elohim, which is a song written by my friend Linnell Griffin. And it holds the key to some of the things that will be popping up in 2023. I'll leave it at that enigmatic statement. Good night, everybody. Happy New Year.